I missed being here at UUCF with you the past two Sundays, but I appreciate Irene Glass and Intern Minister Drail for stepping up and leading those two Sundays. I was on an eight-day retreat for meditation teachers near Pisgah National Forest in North Carolina. And because Megan and I have an almost five-month-old at home, the only way for me to attend this retreat and not get a divorce while I was away was to rent a house about 25 minutes away in nearby Black Mountain, North Carolina. And my mom drove up from South Carolina. So she and Megan took care of the baby during the day, and I drove back each evening to help with the baby overnight and in the morning. We also brought our dog, and since I'm the only one who can walk that maniac at our house, I was in the somewhat unusual circumstance for this more than a week of spending a significant part of each day meditating while also having time each day on the retreat to the commute center, on the commute to the retreat center, while walking the dog, while feeding the baby, to listen to podcasts about the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. So on the one hand, you know, natural beauty was all around me. And I had time around the campfire each evening with my meditation teacher cohort. On the other hand, I was hearing the news daily, as have been so many of you, coming out of Israel and Palestine. So I come before you today with some reactions that have emerged from meditating on this conflict. I offer them with humility and honestly with quite a bit of trepidation, because this is such controversial territory. My hope and intention, which may or may not be the impact, is for this sermon to, on balance, contribute more to healing than to harm in this deeply entrenched cycle of violence. In the words of the Buddhist teacher Larry Yang, may I be loving, open, and aware. May we be loving, open, and aware. May I not cause harm, and to risk a double negative, if I cannot not cause harm, may I cause the least harm possible. In that spirit of cultivating loving awareness and healing, I want to invite you to hear four poems over the course of this sermon. As I've been holding this conflict in my heart, these words in particular have been resonating with me, and I hope they resonate with some of you as well. Poetry engages not only our heads. I see a lot of people only up in their heads with these endless rationalizations from both sides. Poetry invites us to also bring in our hearts and our spirits. I actually think poetry is not a luxury. It is arguably essential even during war, because poems, they point beyond themselves to yet unforeseen possibility. We use poems instead of prose because we don't yet have the prose to work out our problems. We only had the poems to sort of point toward what one day may come to be. I think Emily Dickinson was right on when she said it, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Because when we tell the truth directly, and I'm seeing this happen in this conflict, we tell the truth directly, people just shut down and they get defensive. So she said, tell all the truth, but tell it slant, because success in circuit lies. We've got to spend a little time circling around the problem until we feel safe enough to open up. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth's superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. That wasn't actually one of the four poems. That was just a little bonus. Let us turn then to the first of the four poems that have particularly resonated with me the past few weeks. It's titled Decisions, by Boris Novak. It's about making hard choices amidst seemingly impossible circumstances. Novak writes, between two words, choose the quieter one. Between word and silence, choose listening. Between two books, choose the dustier one. Between earth and sky, choose a bird. Between two animals, choose the one who needs you more. Between two children, choose both. Between the lesser and bigger evil, choose neither. And between hope and despair, choose hope. Hope will be harder to bear. In the midst of this decades-long conflict, what might emerge if we choose listening, not in our echo chambers, but to those whose truth we have not yet heard? What happens if we choose listening? What happens if between children we choose both? What happens if we choose hope over despair, even though hope will be harder to bear? Sarah Kendzior is a journalist and academic. She's been one of the strongest voices within the tide of rising authoritarianism around the world. One of her quotes says, "I don't believe in hope, and I don't believe in hopelessness either. I believe in pragmatism and compassion and doing what is right for its own sake. So I weep for the more than 1,400 Israelis killed and the many more injured on October 7th in the brutal and horrifying Hamas terrorist attack. And I pray for the safe return of the more than 200 hostages, many of whom are children. I also weep for the 9,000 people killed in Gaza in recent weeks, among whom more than 3,000 are children. I hold in my heart that approximately half of Gaza's 2.3 million people are children under the age of 18 who had no chance to vote for Hamas because the last elections were 17 years ago in 2006. I recognize that Israel feels compelled to do all they can to prevent another terrorist attack on the scale of October 7th. And I also hold in my heart the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I think it's important to not just celebrate Dr. King, but to remember his words when they're hardest to hear, not just when they're easiest to celebrate. He writes, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it is a descending spiral, begetting the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, violence multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you cannot murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you murder the hater, but you don't murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out hate. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." It's not an anemic love. This is a very strong love that he's talking about. So I'm listening for the voices who are committed to working together for a future that includes security and dignity for both Israelis and Palestinians. I'm listening for the voices who realize at the deepest existential level, that Jewish lives matter and Palestinian lives matter. Along those lines, I invite you to hear the second of the four poems that have particularly resonated with me the past few weeks. It's titled, "We Cannot Cross Until We Carry Each Other." It's by Ariel Angel, the editor-in-chief of the leftist magazine Jewish Currents, and it plays on the metaphor of the biblical Exodus and the fabled crossing of the Red Sea. She writes, "We cannot cross until we carry each other, all of us refugees and all of us prophets. No more taking turns at history's wheel, trying to collect old debts that no one can pay. The sea will not open that way. This time, that country is what we promise each other. Our rage pressed cheek to cheek until tears flood the spaces between, until there are no enemies left. Because this time, no one will be left to drown. And all of us must be chosen. This time, it is all of us or none. As Dr. King said, we live in this interconnected world house, and we will learn to live together as siblings, or we will perish as fools. That is our choice." Many of you know that in June, I led a group of 20 of us from UUCF on a 10-day pilgrimage to Israel and Palestine. I'm aware this attack was being planned while we were there. I traveled to Israel once previously in 1999. That's me in the center, back when I had long hair. You can kind of tell. That was just a few months prior to the Second Intifada, which is deeply part of what's still going on right now. The difference was that previous trip, we were there about the same amount of time, but it was almost exclusively in Israel, whereas in June, we spent half our time in Palestine, and we went with a tour group that included both a Palestinian tour guide and an Israeli tour guide in dialogue with one another, giving us a dual narrative the whole time. We visited Hebron, Ramallah, the Aida refugee camp near Bethlehem. We broke bread at a Palestinian farm near an Israeli settlement. We ate at the home of Isa Amro, co-founder of Youth Against Settlements. I want to tell you a lot more about that trip in an upcoming sermon on December 10th. For now, I'll just share that the three themes of that trip that shaped our approach were pilgrimage, perspectives, plural, and peace. Because these highlight my general approach to Israel and Palestine. Pilgrimage. There's an old proverb that tells us a tourist passes through a place, a pilgrim allows that place to pass through them. Let's not just pass through the news from Israel and Palestine as outside observers, not for the least of which reasons that our tax dollars make us deeply entrenched in this morass. May we be open to having our hearts, our minds, and our spirits opened in unexpected ways. And perspectives, plural. In the spirit of that dual narrative approach of an Israeli and Palestinian tour guide, we need to listen to people on both sides and everywhere in between. One of the things that makes me respect someone the most, and I'm not seeing much of this these days, what makes me respect someone the most is when I hear them describing the perspective of the person they disagree with in the most charitable way possible. Doesn't mean they agree with them, but making that argument. It's sometimes called, do you know the term steel man argument? It's the opposite of a straw man argument. The straw man argument is to make a BS, you know, description of your opponent and then knock it down. A steel man argument is addressing the strongest form of the other person's argument. We need a lot more of that. Peace. How can we advocate for a transformation of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a way that aligns with our UU sixth principle, the goal of world community? That's MLK's World House, right? The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice, not merely for some, but for all. Many of you know that my wife, Megan, is Jewish. We have family members who were directly impacted by the Holocaust, and both she and many Jewish people we know have directly experienced the spikes in anti-Semitism that have happened in recent years. Of course, it is possible to criticize specific unjust policies of Israel without being anti-Semitic, but it's also true that there are people and groups cynically using the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as motivation for cruel anti-Semitic attacks on Jews and Jewish individuals and groups around the world. A second significant shift, significant influence on me, is that my primary meditation teacher for many years is Palestinian. In 1948, his grandparents became refugees from Palestine. They had a farm in the West Bank. So in 1948, they were part of what became the Nakba, which Palestinians call the catastrophe, and which many Jewish people call Independence Day, right? And this brings us to one of the many divergences within this conflict. What one side celebrates is one of their greatest triumphs for freedom and liberty and independence. Another side mourns as one of their greatest losses of possible liberty and self-determination. So what can we hope to accomplish here today, halfway around the world? I appreciate these words from the Israeli author Yuval Harari, whose best-selling books include Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. How many of you have read it? I suspect, yeah, a fair number of you. From his perspective as an Israeli who is deeply invested in the long arc of human potential and the future potential of our species, Harari writes, "Most Israelis are psychologically incapable at this moment of empathizing with Palestinians. The mind is filled to the brim with our own pain, and there is no space left to even acknowledge the pain of others. Many of the peacemakers in Israel who tried to hold such a space are dead or deeply traumatized by October 7th. Most Palestinians are in an analogous situation. Their minds are too filled with pain to see our pain. But outsiders who are not themselves so deeply immersed in pain should make an effort to empathize with the suffering of all humans, rather than lazily seeing only part of this terrible reality. It is the job of outsiders to help maintain a space for the possibility of peace." The most frequent analogy I've heard in recent days is to the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks here in the U.S. Allow me to lay my cards on the table that in the days after September 11th, my initial reactions were very similar to what they were to do here. I was in graduate school, I was in seminary. I walked across the street from the graduate school to find political science and history professors who could lead teach-ins on the context of what had led to those terrorist attacks. And I was involved in the unfortunately not very effective protests against the Iraq War. In the words of the Jewish journalist Ezra Klein, Israel's 9/11, that's been the refrain. Klein says, I fear that analogy carries more truth than people making it want it to. Because what was 9/11? It was an attack that drowned an entire country, our country, my country, America, in terror and in rage. It drove us mad with fear, and in response, we shredded our liberties. We invaded Afghanistan. We invaded Iraq. Our response to 9/11 led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent people. It made us weaker, and it made us poorer. It made us hated around the world. We didn't pull our forces out of Afghanistan until 2021, 20 years later, and when we left, we did so in humiliation and catastrophe and defeat, abandoning our country to the Taliban. Our politics have not recovered from the ravages of the 9/11 era. With that awareness, I want to invite you to hear the third of the four poems that have particularly resonated with me. It was written 2 weeks after October 7th. And it's titled, The Border is the Wound. It's by Adrienne Marie Brown, an activist and author of a number of really interesting and important books on topics like emergent strategy, pleasure activism, radical imagination, and transformative justice. She writes, I will not let my heart shrink to the size of my oppressors. I will stay soft. I will pray with dignity for the absolute freedom of all humans, from hatred and from the myth of separation. I will dance pure love upon the moon so far from my oppressor that I can return with her heart. Here is how I practice. In war, I keep the dead unsegregated, dreaming together their spirits who know what flesh cannot. I shake off monoliths. I ask right now, who are the prisoners and who are their guards? I do not let those at peace with oppression tell me I am heartless. I do not perform my grief. I weep freely at the altar. I pray up their names. I critique abroad what I critique at home. I know every aspect of my freedom. She's writing as a Black woman. I know every aspect of my freedom is unexpected here. Still precarious. I see all the humanity, the mistakes, the narrow, sharp lives left in the wake of trauma. I know my country well. We always think our motives invisible. We are always naked. In my hand are thousands of rivers of pain, confusion, misinformation, fury. But the eyes of those children watch me. I start at the freshest cut. As the earth whispers, the border is the wound. Having spent quite a lot of time recently meditating on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, let me also share just a few insights about why go on retreat in the midst of war? Like, how do you justify like spiritual practice? You know, should we instead be out on the front lines? For me, at least, spiritual practice is not about running away from the world. That's just spiritual bypassing. Spiritual practice is about preparing our hearts and our minds and our body and our spirit to engage in activism with our whole self and in skillful, wise ways. I actually think a lot of activism without spiritual practice ends up doing more damage than it means to. So very, very briefly, these are the six ways to meditate my own Sangha, Buddhist Geeks, tends to emphasize. And they're all interconnected. You know, if you heard me talk before about spiritual cross-training, we need to do these different types. I just want to say a little bit about what it was like to meditate in the midst of all this and what that kind of brought. So that first way to meditate in the top left-hand corner, the one dot, that's concentration. Being able to bring one-pointed focus. And it really felt profound to be able to concentrate where I see a lot of people, they feel so scattered and all over the place. Spiritual practice can help us focus and concentrate. mindfulness is those polka dots in the upper right hand of the corner. Mindfulness is about noticing what's going on with you in real time. And some of you have heard the most skillful way I know to be mindful is the shift from I am to there is. Instead of I am anxious, oh, there is anxiety. But what else is there? Oh, there's curiosity. Oh, there's peace. There's just the feeling of coolness on my hands. There's warmth. Mindfulness is about just noticing all that's happening with you. Or practicing heartfulness, continuing to move to that heart. Practicing the intention when there's so much division of setting these intentions, you're tuning the GPS of your heart toward loving kindness and compassion, toward equanimity. Thich Nhat Hanh used to say equanimity is actually not the best translation. A better translation of equanimity is inclusion. How much are you including? Because you're truly equanimous if you're really including everything. Or joy is another of the heartfulness practices. Or bodyfulness is the tree in the bottom left. A lot of people are not in their bodies right now. Just like getting out of your head and just noticing like, what's happening in my body? That can shift things. Awareness practices, that cloud, just being able to open up into a more spacious place. There's a saying with awareness practices that the sun is always out on whatever happening in the weather, the sun is always out on the other side of the clouds. And that kind of deep awareness of that. And finally, inquiry questions, just kind of dropping these questions. You'll see why I ask these two in particular with the fourth poem in a few moments. But asking yourself the question, who do I love? And what do I doubt? Sitting with those questions. I've also been reflecting on what the Buddhist tradition calls the three poisons. The three poisons are greed, or attachment, delusion and ignorance, hatred and aversion. These poisons are what keep us strapped onto the wheel of samsara, the wheel of suffering, just spinning around and around. They just fuel it. They keep us trapped in these habitual patterns and locked into cycles of violence. When I think of greed and attachment, I'm going to be really honest, I think of extremist Israeli settlers and those who, you know, encourage them grabbing more and more land and each time making the two-state solution harder and harder to reach. And I think about extremists like Hamas poisoning hopes for peace through terrorist violence. I think about delusion and ignorance, that only seeing separateness, only seeing one side of a complex narrative. And I see a lot of hatred and aversion. But good news, there are also antidotes to these poisons. Buddhism teaches that these are the most powerful tools for breaking free from these entrenched patterns of harm and working for the liberation of all sentient beings. And I want you to notice, as I briefly go through these, can you feel a shift in your heart, in your body, in your mind, as I name the antidotes for the poison? Can you feel, what's the difference when you go from attachment or greed to generosity? Can you feel the difference there of how do you approach a conflict, with attachment or with generosity? I mean, just think about like bad divorces you're familiar with, you know, or good, you know, are they, you know, greed, generosity, attachment, generosity. Delusion, I see a lot of delusion right now. And I see very few people really acting from wisdom. You know, really acting for the wisdom of my neighbor is myself. Many people in love, in hatred instead of love. Many of you remember Alad, our Israeli tour guide, who many of you had the chance to hear preach from this pulpit just a few weeks ago, you know, saying, an enemy is one whose story I do not, you know, have not yet heard. He's just seen that over and over. But so much Israelis and Palestinians often never have a chance to meet each other when it's not at the barrel of a gun. Holding in your heart these three antidotes, I invite you to hear the fourth and final poem, which has been the one I've been sitting with for the most years in regard to Israel and Palestine. It was written in Yehuda Amichai died in 2000. It's titled, The Places Where We Are Right. Amichai was born in Germany in 1924. In 1936, at the age of 12, he immigrated to Palestine with his family. In 1948, he was a soldier in the First Arab-Israeli War. And as a result of his experiences, he became an advocate for peace and reconciliation and was often involved with dialogues with Palestinian poets or writers. This poem was born out of that work for peace and dialogue with Palestinian poets. Amichai writes, from the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. Because the place where we are right, it is hard and it is trampled like a yard. Feel that, what it's like in you when you know you're right. But doubts and loves. Doubts and loves dig up the world like a mole, like a plow. And a whisper will be heard in the places where the ruined house once stood. There's a lot of ruined houses. We've got to listen for those whispers of doubt and love that can lead us forward together. This conflict between Israel and Palestine has often been described as right versus right. Both sides have legitimate claims and legitimate grievances. And if you're right, it's really hard to let go. Why should you? You're right. But that leaves everyone trapped in these entrenched habitual patterns of deep, deep suffering. One of the most tragic examples of what can happen if you only act from the place where you are right is in 1995, when the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated because of his work for peace with Palestinians. But he was shot, many of you will remember, not by a Palestinian. The Israeli Prime Minister was shot by a right-wing Jewish Israeli who opposed the Oslo peace process. That right-wing Jewish zealot could only see from the place where he was right. What would it mean to approach the Israel and Palestinian conflict with doubts and loves as our entry point? Love shifts us out of hatred and creates the possibility for generosity to emerge. Doubt shifts us out of delusion toward wisdom. What do you doubt? What do you love? The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said it this way in his first book titled Stride Toward Freedom, The Montgomery Story. He said, love means a recognition of the fact that all life is interrelated. All of humanity is involved in a single process. Some of you have heard me say before, to me, the deepest truth that I've discovered meditating is, and this to me is what quantum physics tells us as well, is that it is process and relationship all the way down. It's process and relationship all the way down. And all humans, King said, are related. We know after Darwin, we're all cousins. We're all cousins on the tree of life. And so to the degree, King says, that I harm my fellow human, no matter what they are doing to me, to the extent I do that, I'm harming myself. That's the poisonous seeds for the future. For example, King said, white men often refuse federal aid to education in order to avoid giving the black people their right. But because we're all interrelated, you cannot deny black children without harming white children. You're only hurting yourself. If you harm me, you harm yourself. When I am commanded to love, I am commanded to restore community, to resist injustice, and to meet the needs of my fellow human being. King's final book, released just a year before his assassination, was titled, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? I think about that with the Israelis and the Palestinians. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community? What might King say if he were alive today? His daughter, who runs the King Center, quoted this her dad might say as what he did say about the Vietnam War. He said, if we assume that humankind has a right to survive, we must find an alternative to war and destruction. In a day when Sputniks dash through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, nobody actually wins a war. The choice today is no longer between violence and nonviolence. It is between nonviolence and nonexistence. On the final night of our trip to Israel and Palestine this summer, we met with two members of the Parent Circle. It's a joint Israeli-Palestinian organization of more than 600 families who have all lost an immediate family member to this conflict. That could just keep them apart, but instead it's brought them together to say, in the memory of my dead loved one, let this madness stop. If you spend time listening to both Israeli and Palestinian families who have lost loved ones in this tragedy, it quickly becomes clear that Palestinian and Israelis, they're just humans who use almost identical language to describe their grief. This shared language around loss can remind us of the common humanity that runs far deeper than any surface conflict and that can build bridges to a future, even between people who've experienced the most devastating losses imaginable. Again, as Elad said, so much of what keeps the conflict going is that Israelis and Palestinians have so few opportunities to meet each other and hear their stories. An enemy, he said, is again one whose story we haven't heard. I want to weave in just one final layer, and that's the framework of our own Unitarian Universalist tradition. Many of you know that we UUs are in the process that may be final this June of rewriting our principles and sources, and this proposed graphic represents our shared UU values with love at the center of the chalice. In that graphic, you can see the Buddhist antidotes of love and generosity explicitly included. Generosity is ingrained there on the left. I suggested including wisdom as well. They didn't care what I thought. But you can also see other values that we've been talking about related to Israel and Palestine. You see the value of pluralism down at the bottom, right? That's that perspective. There's not just one perspective here. There's pluralism. We also see the value of transformation. The way things are, they truly are not the way they always have to be. And I'll talk more. There are other examples, I think, from Northern Ireland. It was so hard to see another way to that. The fact that Angela Merkel, I just remember thinking, the fact that Angela Merkel is Chancellor of Germany. It wasn't that long ago that Adolf Hitler was Chancellor of Germany, right? Deep, deep change can truly come in ways. Europe had what is called the 100 Years' War, but it's not still going. It did last 100 years, and we want this to. So there is hope that this can change. The value of equity. Every person has the right to flourish. Every human has inherent worth and dignity. And interdependence and justice. As King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice anywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. The Israelis and Palestinians and all of us are caught in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. In that same spirit of love, the following message was written by a Palestinian to a Jewish friend a few days after October 7th and has been circulating on Twitter. I don't call it that other name. I'm still in denial. He wrote, "At these times, I imagine that mainly people are frightened and that they're looking for safety. I have this need to communicate that despite everything that's happening, I love you. And I love you even more. And I open my heart and my soul, and I dedicate my life to create a safe space for all of us, for you, for all of you, and for all of me. I'm here. I see you. I feel you. And I love you. And nothing that ever happens will erase the compassion I have for you and for us." And I want to tell you, and you can talk to the other folks who went on this trip to Israel and Palestine, I saw that sentiment over and over and over with the Palestinians and Israelis that we talked to who did actually have chances to get to know one another. Imagining a future with hope and dignity and security for both Israelis and Palestinians will require the antidotes of love and generosity and wisdom, and a shift from one-sided either-or thinking to both-and thinking that is deeply invested in co-creating a future for all. Yes, I do believe we need a ceasefire, or fine, humanitarian pause, if you prefer. And Israel needs to recalibrate away from bombing toward targeted counterterrorism, which would help stop these massive civilian casualties that are only sowing poisonous seeds of hatred that is fueling the cycle of violence. Hamas, of course, needs to return the hostages and find ways that we can say, I think Hamas needs to be out of power. Obviously, should have never been allowed to run in the first place, and that terrorist attacks are not going to resume. Outside nations with influence need to urge the respective sides to make commitments now to a lasting peace after the war. That presumably looks like Israelis rolling back significant numbers of settlements. It looks like Palestinian leadership committing to no further terrorist violence. I could just keep going back and forth with so many more examples, but I don't think that's the best use of our time, because the more foundational point is there are two peoples who feel deep ancestral ties to the same land. We're either going to help them, and they will find ways to live together as siblings, or they're going to perish together as fools. And I just don't know which. And all I know to do is to keep listening and lifting up the voices who are committing to working together for a future that includes dignity and security for both Israelis and Palestinians, those voices who deeply, existentially feel that Jewish lives matter and Palestinian lives matter. There's so much more to say. I often have one or two pages of sermon notes that end up on the cutting room floor. For this sermon, I have 10 more pages, single-spaced, of notes. We're not going to do that. I want to end by inviting you to hear the fourth and final poem once more. From the place where we are right, flowers will never grow in the spring. From the place where we are right, it's hard and it's trampled like a yard. But doubts and love, they dig up the world like a mole, like a plow. And a whisper will be heard in the place where the ruined house once stood. In that spirit, let's rise, embody your spirit, in your teal hymnals, turn to 10:15, I know I can.